Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of the show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. From NPR, Off Bollywood's Beaten Path, a Killer Political Satire. Nata, a farmer in central India, is in danger of losing his land because he can't repay a loan. But all of his problems could be solved through a government program that would award his relatives with a staggering 100,000 rupees, which is about $2,000. The catch? Nata will have to commit suicide for his family to get the money. This is the premise of Peeply Live, a Bollywood satire that had its American premiere in mid-August. The movie's story is fictional, as in the village, Peeply, where it takes place, but the phenomenon it examines is all too real. In recent years, hundreds of thousands of Indian farmers have killed themselves because they are unable to pay their debts, and India's government really does compensate their families. It's like an epidemic, says Amir Khan, the Bollywood veteran who produced Peeply Live. Between 1991 and 2001 alone, 200,000 farmers took their own lives, he says. That's really a scary and heartbreaking thought. Despite the widespread nature of the phenomenon, farmer suicide isn't the sort of thing that a Bollywood movie would normally depict. Mainstream films in India don't usually tackle such serious topics, Khan, one of the biggest names in that business, tells NPR's Linda Werthmeyer. But I just love it, so I wanted to do it. The subject matter isn't the only thing that makes Peeply Live unusual. The film's satirical tone also sets it apart from the bulk of what the Hindi film industry produces. And it's not light satire. Nata's family members, Khan notes, are impatient for him to go ahead and close the deal. His son asks him, "Dad, when are you committing suicide? Because Uncle says when you're dead, I'll become a contractor," and stuff like that. Local politicians and the media come in for a merciless skewering. There's a local election happening at that point in time, which is why things completely spiral out of control, Khan says. Meanwhile, ruthless TV news crews jockey to film Nata's imminent suicide live. There's been a sudden growth of the media, Khan says, and as a result, a lot of the reporting is extremely sensational with an eye on just getting the ratings. To Khan, the film takes on politics and the media is reflective on all of us as a society and how we do, in fact, move towards stories which are sensational. What plays out in the village of Peeply is very funny when you watch it, he continues, but the sad fact is that it's actually not very far from the truth. In fact, some elements of Peeply Live blur the lines between truth and fiction. One of the film's featured songs is a tune that director Anusha Rizvi first heard being played by a local group of musicians when she was shooting on location at a small village. Not an upbeat Bollywood-style extravaganza about romance or rivalry, it's a song about the ravages of inflation, with lyrics like, "My husband earns a lot of money, but inflation, that which eats it all away every month. This is a song they had written for themselves, all the villagers, and they were singing it, and she really loved it, recalls Khan. Khan knows that he's taking a risk by producing such an explicitly political film in a country where reasonable expectations say it'll find a niche audience at best. But he's come to believe it's his job to make movies with a message. I don't know who else will do it, he says. When I come across material which excites me, which not only is engaging and entertaining, but also has something to say, or hopefully sensitizes people or makes you think, I'd like to be a part of that. And that's about Peepli Live, a movie which is produced in India about suicides by farmers in order to get government assistance to the families, as was reported by NPR. The reality of how debt can lead to such tragic ends makes me feel very fortunate that we have a system where a fresh start through bankruptcy can be attained to deal with creditors. And from Dean Baker at Guardian.com UK, that U.S. banks can skirt the paperwork required for home foreclosures shows it's one rule for them and another for us. Virtually everyone has had some experience of being forced to pay a late fee or bank penalty because of some fine print provision that we overlooked. Sometimes begging by good customers can win forbearance, but usually we are held to the written terms of the contract, no matter how buried or convoluted the clause in question may be. That is the way it works for the rest of us, but apparently this is not the way the banks do business, at least when those at the other end of the contract are ordinary homeowners. As a number of news reports have shown in recent weeks, banks have been carrying through foreclosures at a breakneck pace and freely ignoring the legal niceties required under the law, such as demonstrating clear ownership to the property being foreclosed. The problem is that when mortgages get sliced and diced into various mortgage-backed securities, it became difficult to follow who actually held the title to the home. Often the bank that was servicing the mortgage did not actually have the title and may not even know where the title is. As a result, if a homeowner stopped paying their mortgage, the servicer may not be able to prove they actually have a claim to the property. If the servicer followed the law on carrying through foreclosures, then it would have to go through a costly and time-consuming process of getting its paperwork in order and ensuring that it actually did have possession of the title before going to a judge and getting a judgment that would allow them to take possession of the property. Instead, banks got in the habit of skirting the proper procedures and filling in forms inaccurately and improperly in order to take possession of the properties. GMAC, the former financing arm of General Motors, and now called Ally Financial, has become the poster child for these sort of practices. Jeffrey Steven, a leader of one of its foreclosure units, acknowledged that he had signed thousands of affidavits claiming that he had reviewed documents he had never seen. In addition to being a subprime lender during the heyday of the housing bubble, Ally Financial also has the notoriety of being primarily owned by the federal government following its collapse last year. This fact may ensure greater accountability at Ally, but there is no reason to believe that its practices are qualitatively different than those of other servicers carrying through foreclosures. The basic point is that the banks foreclosing on homes don't feel that they should be held to the letter of the law like ordinary people. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And continuing with the article, as we approach the two-year anniversary of TARP, it is certainly understandable that the big banks think the laws that apply to others don't apply to them. After all, The lesson of TARP was that when the banks got themselves into trouble with their reckless lending, the taxpayers would come to the rescue with whatever loans and guarantees were needed to keep them in business. In fact, many of the bankers who were begging Congress for below-market loans 2 years ago are now bragging about having paid back the money with interest. This should prompt ridicule. Instead, all the reporters and columnists who were too thick to see an $8 trillion housing bubble are repeating the bank's lines and telling us how happy we should be about the bailouts. In the financial crisis of 2 years ago, these banks would have been forced to pay enormous interest rates to borrow money in private markets. This would have pushed most of them into bankruptcy. Instead, the Treasury and the Fed gave them money at near zero cost. This was an enormous subsidy that allowed them to stay in business. It's nice that the banks tossed a few nickels in interest, but the taxpayers preserved trillions of dollars in wealth for their shareholders, top executives, and creditors. We would have a very different economy with a very different wealth distribution if we had allowed the magic of the market to do its work on the financial industry. But that's history. The current issue is whether we will again grant special treatment to the financial industry by allowing them to skirt the legal procedures required for foreclosures. In the land of endless affirmative action for the rich, the smart money is on the banks. After all, huge multinational banks can't be expected to read all the fine print that binds the rest of us. And that's an article, Foreclosure Funny Business, by Dean Baker at The Guardian. So we'll continue on now with our study of the two-income trap, Why Middle-Class Parents Are Going Broke, by Elizabeth Warren and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi. And the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren and Amelia, two of America's leading champions for debtors. I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two-Income Trap. You can also listen to all of the shows that have been produced to help you deal with debt issues by going to the archives at www.kruufm.com and look under Life and Debt. We're actually coming to a wind down of the study in which Professor Warren is really advocating that people in the middle class families get proactive to help create some change to protect the middle class. She says that we wish we could offer some clever advice that would tell everyone how to sidestep the financial landmines associated with parenthood, but we can't. The financial fire drill can help curb at least a few of the dangers of modern economic life, but it cannot negate the fundamental fact that having children has been an enormously risky undertaking, as all parents know. Nor can the financial fire drill protect an individual parent from the vagaries of the marketplace. And just to remind people that the financial fire drill basically has us respond to three basic questions. Can your family survive without one income? Can you downshift the fixed expenses? And what is your emergency backup plan? And this has been discussed in great expansive detail in former shows. That's the financial fire drill. And then we also discussed what to do when the house is already on fire, which means basically financially the debt service is in the extreme. So we just concluded that the financial fire drill, even if you can contend with those questions and address them appropriately, will not protect an individual parent from the vagaries of the marketplace. As long as the only way parents can guarantee a decent education for their children is to buy an overpriced home in the suburbs, families will continue to take on ruinous mortgages. So long as the cost of preschool remain a family's responsibility rather than a public duty, parents will continue to struggle. So long as colleges can get away with doubling tuition every generation to pay for sports teams and armies of new administrators, families will be stretched even further. And so long as Congress refuses to impose some basic interest rate regulations, credit card companies and mortgage lenders will continue to drain tens of billions of dollars out of the pockets of middle-class American families each year, now that we have the foreclosure crisis reigning supreme across the land. What Professor Warren and Amelia say is that their advice is born out of hope rather than sound financial reasoning. If you feel called to be a parent, don't stop fulfilling that desire just because of the reality of having children and the costs. Follow your heart is what she says. You may lose your home and you may go bankrupt, but we hope that the joys will outweigh the financial pain. And besides, what other advice would you expect from two working mothers who believe in the great American middle class and who pray for its strong future, that being both Elizabeth and Amelia? And they say if you become a parent, they believe that you have an extra duty beyond providing for your child's needs. You have a duty to speak up. And by virtue of the data in their books, which show that families cannot protect themselves alone, they want us all to write to our representatives in Congress and petition your school board and speak out. At the turn of the century, there were 63 million parents in America, and that number has gone up substantially in the last decade. And if we can get all of the parents together and have a strong voice, that can certainly make a difference. If you are to survive financially, you and other parents must band together for change. The survival of your interest group, parents, depends on it. And there really is another reason that we should act as parents, not for ourselves or for other parents, but for future parents, according to Professor Warren. We should take action on behalf of the children. Her book, The Two-Income Trap, was made in part to create some anger. And again, I highly recommend that people go and get this book, The Two-Income Trap. This is by some honest people who speak based on real statistics and experience. There are those who are convinced that the problem with American families can be summed up by materialism and irresponsibility, and they will denounce this book and these writers as hopeless apologists. While spokespersons for the lending industry will puff about how much good all that debt has done for the American family. And then there's the politicians who have taken billions of dollars to protect the giant banks will pointedly ignore this kind of thinking and this book while they loudly reaffirm that they are pro-family. And there will be no shortage of people who will continue to denounce the financially unlucky as moral failures. But as the professor points out, there is one fact that will be hard for even our most vocal critics to ignore. Every year, an estimated 1.6 million children or more go along for the ride when their parents declare bankruptcy. That means that more kids will be listed in their parents' bankruptcies than will sign up for Little League, or adopt a dog from the Humane Society, or even get braces on their teeth. If current trends continue, soon we will be seeing one of every seven children in the United States will have lived through their parents' bankruptcies. And that's a big number. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And about bankruptcy and children, soon we'll have seen one of every seven children in the United States having lived through their parents' bankruptcy. Much like divorce, bankruptcy is about a destabilized family. A whole nation has focused on the difficulties that children face when their parents divorce, while the problem of financial distress among middle-class parents is widely, widely ignored. And yet, in any given year, more children will live through their parents' bankruptcy than their parents' divorce. For these kids, bankruptcy is not simply a matter of having less spending money or getting fewer new clothes. Like the children of divorce, the children of economic failure lose the life they once knew. In some cases, the effects of deteriorating family finances are subtle, difficult for a child to comprehend. Mom cries a lot, dad sits home all day, the heat's been shut off. In other cases, the fallout is abrupt. Foreclosure notice stuck to the front door, a cramped apartment on the other side of town, a new school, and sometimes the spillover is totally unexpected. The professor gives an example of a young woman, a 38-year-old mother in California, who tried to insulate her 11-year-old son from the financial fallout of her husband's job loss. She carefully hid the past due notices, told him the telephone was shut off due to a mechanical difficulty, and said the car was towed away because the transmission was broken. But then came the phone call that forced her to admit that she and her husband could no longer shield him. Our son has braces. When the dentist was informed of the bankruptcy, they called and said they wouldn't see our son anymore. After a series of humiliating phone calls, she finally found an orthodontist who was willing to remove her son's braces for cash in advance. Then she had to explain to her 11-year-old son what had gone wrong in their lives, why a stranger would take off his braces while his teeth were still crooked, and how his life was about to change. When a radical change occurs in a child's life, divorce, moving to a new city, or even the birth of a new sibling, parents typically alert other adults in the child's life, asking them to give additional support and to watch for signs of trouble. But middle-class parents don't tell the teachers, the pediatrician, the school counselor, the babysitter, that their youngster may be experiencing distress because mom and dad are on the brink of bankruptcy. This leaves children isolated, confused, and conscious that something shameful is going on. The code of silence makes it difficult for these children to seek out friends who have lived through the same experience. Children become more isolated, cut off from their peers. Over time, this can evolve into keeping secrets and telling lies. Professor Catherine Newman, in her book Falling from Grace, quotes the advice an unemployed father gave his son. In his school, everybody's father is the head of this and that. So I said, "You can tell them your dad was VP of a company and he just refused to go on overseas assignments. I told him if anybody asks, tell them I started my own firm." So now we have parents advocating telling lies. What's the child going to think? Politicians may contend that financial collapse has lost its stigma, but children living through it may not see it that way at all. A handful of academic studies provide some hints about the future of these children. The catalog of damages inflicted on children when their parents divorce, falling test scores, low self-esteem, discipline problems, depression, also applies for middle-class children whose parents are in financial trouble. Financial collapse has an additional wrinkle less common among children of divorce. It often sends a child into adult roles long before his time. Newman observes, for downwardly mobile families, it is the parents who need their kids' emotional support. Their children want to be more independent, but a sense of responsibility and obligation pulls them back. Not all parents try to shield their children from this stress. Sometimes the protection goes the other way. Many children, some as young as 9 or 10, learn to screen the incoming phone calls to shield their parents from bill collectors. An example given by Professor Warren was of a person who said that when her husband's business failed, two men came to the door when the woman was at work. They said that they read that we were going to be foreclosed on and that they would either buy the house at auction or give us loans to help us out. Her son told them to get off the property and never come back. He must have looked so small and skinny next to those two men, but he was certainly mad. If you care about children, about whether they succeed or fail academically, about whether they are self-confident or self-loathing, about whether they are thriving or under so much stress that they can't sleep at night, then you should care about family economics. If you care about children, then you should speak out. Conservative columnist William F. Buckley Jr. describes the bankruptcy procedure as follows. What has caused the acceleration of bankruptcies is the painlessness of the operation plus little avenues of abuse attractive to high-class bankrupts. You come back one day from the corner lawyer and say, I don't owe anybody anything anymore. Professor Warren says, we're not sure who was on Mr. Buckley's interview list as he developed his insights into how families respond to financial failure. We are pretty sure it was not one of the thousands of children who have just lost the home they grew up in. We also suspect it was not one of the millions of devastated parents who are watching the symbols and security associated with their children's place in the middle class crumble away. But we know that every person who has read that column and who did not call Mr. Buckley to task for his cheap cynicism helped make life a little harder for a whole lot of children and their parents. The families that Professor Warren studied weren't so different from our own. There were people who made everyone laugh, people who dreamed big, people who made some really stupid choices. More than anything else, the families whose lives animated her book worked hard, played by the rules, and failed. And I'm going to say that again. They worked hard, they played by the rules, and they failed. They made many of the same choices everyone makes in the middle class. They went to college. They bought homes. They sent both parents into the workforce. But they got caught in a trap of circumstances that would not let them go, and they ended up in a study of financial failure. And that means the study that Professor Warren did to create the book, The Two-Income Trap. She says that we believe in these families, but the rules they played by are no longer the rules that govern financial success for the middle class. In one single generation, the world has changed and families are struggling to adapt. They committed themselves to thrift and hard work in exchange for a promise of economic security and a better future for their children. That promise has disappeared. There was a time when families sent mothers into the workplace only in times of distress. Today, women go to work every day just to maintain a tenuous grasp on a middle-class life. Plenty of families make it, but a growing number of those who have worked just as hard and followed the rules just as carefully find themselves in a financial nightmare. And I will finish up with this next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt-manageable life.